case of an event such as this. And they knew that what happened almost 10 days ago now could happen. They knew that it was indeed a possibility. And so they had planned for such an eventuality. They knew what they wanted to take with them. They could get out very quickly if they had to. They actually knew where they would go. He and his wife, with their family, would go to Memphis, Tennessee, where they knew they would have support. They knew they would have a place to live. Both of them knew that they could line up a job, and they could work there, and they could stay there indefinitely or move there permanently if they had to. They knew that. And so they were prepared for such a thing that took place. And so when it looked like the worst was about to happen, they carried out their plan just like they thought they would have to. And now they live and they work in Memphis, Tennessee. The children are in school. So in such a case, it was very important to have a plan so that he would be able to save his family and himself. Now, God has such a plan to save mankind. You might say, well, there's a number of ways we can go with this particular story. Well, there is. God, first of all, has a plan to save mankind. We are aware of that plan, and we are learning more about it each time we observe the holy days of the seventh month, because it is those holy days in which tells us that God is going to step in the affairs of man, and he's going to rescue us from ourselves in the way that we've been going for the past 6,000 years. However, a little more closer to home, we want to ask this question. Does God have a plan for his people during the end time events? Does God promise protection for his people in the end time? I think it's a very good time to talk about that particular subject. I don't think we've talked about it for quite a long time. In fact, people have asked me, well, does the church believe in a place of safety? That's the way it is normally put to me. And, of course, the Bible doesn't necessarily say quite those words. It does speak about a place, and we will read that particular scripture. But we ought to ask, what does God tell us about protection during the end time? Now, most people will take reasonable precaution, but there will come a time when some of the best laid plans to save you and your family simply will not work. It may be just too much happening. According to the way we read the prophecies in the Bible, that when God begins to step in, and if his judgment, the tribulation as it's called, that's going to come upon man that has never occurred like this before, nor will it ever again. It would certainly tax any country their means to be able to help their people. And we can see what happened even at the best of times when the people simply were, I mean, it would, people, they were not prepared to help in this particular disaster in the way they should have been. And this is all emerging now. To where they could have done a lot more and should have, and of course they didn't. There will come a time when we might be able to make some plans like this man did who moved to Memphis, Tennessee. Let me say, I think on a, you know, for reasonable circumstances where we can make some plans, I think we ought to. I think we need to think about, where would we go? What would we do if we had to evacuate? You might say, well, I don't think it's going to flood where I am. Well, there are plenty other things that can happen. And it doesn't have to be a flood. It doesn't have to be a hurricane, though we did have one back in 1974 that where a lot of Brisbane was underwater, and people died as a result of that. There could be a number of other things that could happen, not just that. That could be very, very destructive, where it would be necessary for you to move to another place. It speaks where the people had to go from one city to another city. They had to leave. They had to be, so they had to escape where they were. Well, and Christ even speaks about that. And perhaps that's not only a reference for 70 AD when they had to leave Jerusalem, but it could also have overtones for what would occur now. All right, the question would be then, do we have any plans ourselves? I think it would be prudent to have some kind of an idea. Where would you go? Who do you know out west? Now, on the other hand, the people out west might say, who do I know in Brisbane that I could come to? Well, we might have to do that too. It's to have some kind of an idea, not to go through a weekend or overnight with an empty tank. You know, no petrol in your car. You know what I mean? I'm just simply saying there could be a time when you might have to say, hey, let's get out of here real fast for the sake of you and your family. These are just ordinary, normal precautions, something we wouldn't have said a year ago or 2 years ago. Now we might start to think about it. Hey, let's start thinking about that. Maybe there's something that we ought to do. However, doors for escape may be completely shut. It may be you won't have any place to go. And when God begins to judge the whole world according to the way he describes in the Bible, will God's people be in harm's way? I think that's a good question. In the New Orleans flood, some people who were obedient to God lost much of what they had. Most got out. For the most part, their properties were spared. However, not all. There is support from the church, as well as from relatives living in other parts of the country. Most people would have insurance. Most people in that part of the country would even have flood insurance, which they could get, which is extra, which is not normally a part of insurance. Then the government agencies who will step in and then give financial help. But this particular one affected God's people as well as others. God's people lived there. As we said, we had in those three churches that were affected 165 people who lived there. So we have to ask the question, what does God say about protection? Does the same judgment come upon everyone, or does God make a difference? We have an expectation, a hope of what God will do for his people in the end time. Is that expectation well-founded? Do we have a right to hope for God's protection, for God's safety, for God's salvation at the end time? And when I use the word salvation, I use it in the way that it is used most of the time in the Old Testament, meaning salvation or being saved from physical harm, not spiritual salvation necessarily. Now, this is not a new question. It's been asked before. One of the first place I believe it was asked is back in Genesis, the 18th chapter. And Abraham himself asked the question. Let's notice this in Genesis chapter 18, beginning with verse 16. The Lord and two angels visited Abraham. Verse 16, then the men arose from there and looked toward Sodom, and Abraham went with them to send them on the way. And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I am doing? Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. Now, this is a principle. God, when he does something, tells his servants, the prophets. We find that in Amos, the third chapter, reiterated there. And, of course, here is one of the first occurrences, not the first, but one of the early occurrences where God reveals what he is going to do to one of his prophets. And Abraham was considered to be a prophet. Now, he goes on to say, verse 20, the Lord said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grave, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it that has come to me. And if not, I will know. Now, this is just another way of saying he is about to render his judgment upon these two cities. And then the men turned away from there and went towards Sodom. But Abraham still stood before the Lord. And Abraham came near and said, Would you also destroy the righteous with the wicked? Now, here's the question. This is it, right here. Would you do this? You would notice that Abraham came near. A person who is obedient to God will come near to God. He can do this. And he can also ask this kind of a question, whereas most other people perhaps would not. Abraham would. And so there it is. It's out there. He just says it. This is on his mind. Then he goes on and he, as perhaps a little bit of an explanation, suppose there were 50 righteous within the city, would you also destroy the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous that were in it? Be it far from you to do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous should be as the wicked. Far be it from you, you shall not the judge of the earth do right. You might say, well, that's pretty bold for Abraham to talk to God face to face this way. He would say, you know, will the judge of the earth. Now, he's acknowledging that God has a right to do this because he is the judge of all the earth. He can do whatever he wants. That's none of the question. But will he then bring forth his judgment if there are, say, 50 righteous in the city who would also likely to be destroyed if he destroys the city? So the Lord said, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous people within the city, then I will spare the place for their sakes. So he's making several points here. Would you destroy the righteous with the wicked? Will the judge of all the earth do what is right? God answers this way. He answers the question the way it was asked. God acknowledged, if there were sufficient righteous people in the place, he would not destroy it, regardless of how bad it was. Now, this tells us how God might look upon a situation and make a decision. If you've got righteous people there, or sufficient righteous people, I won't even destroy it. It's a pretty bad place, because that becomes the benchmark. Remember, Sodom and Gomorrah is the benchmark for all bad places upon whom God's judgment will come much later. He uses that as the standard, as it were, that here is now the kind of judgment that's going to come upon those cities or populations that are similar to Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, he goes on to have a discussion with God and gets it down in verse 32 to 10 people. He says, well, what about 40? What about 30? What about 20? Now he says 10. And then he said, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak but once more. Suppose 10 should be found in it. And he said, I will not destroy it for the sake of 10. Now, Abraham stops there. Maybe he thought, I went far enough. I don't need to go any further here. I'm pushing it too far with God to ask him to get it down to 5. But what's he thinking? He's probably thinking about Lot, who is in Sodom. And he says, okay, you got Lot, his wife, he's got a couple of daughters, he's got sons-in-law, they got their wives. I think we can get 10 people out of this. So he stops at 10. Now I'm just guessing, but I think that's probably what he's doing. So he thinks, okay, I think we got Lot saved. Maybe God won't destroy it. If we got 10 people then who are considered to be righteous. Now, when God saw then that there was no good reason, when he got there was no good reason to redeem Sodom and Gomorrah, he proceeded to destroy it, but not before removing the righteous and even giving the opportunity to some whose heart was not so righteous, giving them a chance to get out of there. Now, that's what he was doing. Now, he went ahead with his plan to destroy it, but he changed the plan a little bit. He said, I'll just get them out of there. So let's notice in verse 12 of chapter 19. Now, this is very interesting. Here are the two angels then dealing with Lot. The men said to Lot, Have you anyone else here? Son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, and whomever you have in the city, take them out of this place, for we will destroy this place, for the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out, and he spoke to his sons-in-law, who had married his daughters, and said, get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city. And but to his sons-in-law, he seemed to be joking. Wow. So they weren't going to listen. Then the morning dawned, and the angels urged Lot to hurry. So all night happened. The sons-in-laws never showed up with the families. So they urged him to hurry, saying, arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed with the punishment of the city. And while he lingered, he didn't want to go. I don't know why he lingered. Maybe he was still hoping someone would show up, like his sons-in-law, for instance. Parts of his family scattered around the city. The men took hold of his hand, his wife's hand, and the hands of his two daughters, and the Lord being merciful to him, and they brought him out and set him outside the city. You almost get the idea. It's like a bouncer. You know, they're going to move this guy out. We've got to get him out. If he's going to be safe, we got to toss him out. He's not going on his own. And you take a look at New Orleans and how some people are very reluctant to leave. You know, they don't want to leave. Well, you got to go. You really need to go. No, I don't want to leave. Well, about like that. It came to pass when they brought him outside the city that he said, that the angel said, escape for your life. Do not look behind you, nor stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be destroyed. So get to the mountains. Everything down here is going to be destroyed. And Lot said to them, please know my Lord. No, don't. Indeed, now your servant has found favor in your sight, which you have increased your mercy, and which you have shown me by saving my life. But I cannot escape to the mountains, lest some evil overtake me and I die. See now, this city is near enough to flee to, and it is a little one. Please let me escape there. Is it not a little one, and my soul shall live? And he said to him, see, I have favored you concerning this thing also, that I will not overthrow the city for which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you have arrived there. Therefore, the name of the city was called Zoar, meaning little or insignificant. For the first time, there was a town that was very happy that it was insignificant because it did not get destroyed. But they said, all right, if you want to take your dog, take your dog. I could just see the National Guard people in New Orleans say, I can't take your dog. I'm not leaving without my dog. You've seen these pictures? They don't want to leave. And it's kind of this is human nature. There's all kind of reasons why they don't want to leave someplace they think is safe. Now, they told them, don't look back even. The Lord rained fire and brimstone. Verse 26, the wife looked back behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. And so we have a number of things going on here that's quite amazing when we see God who simply steps in, who intends to rescue Lot. For all of Lot's character, all of Lot's good points and righteousness and obedience, that God decided to save him, he was by no means perfect. His sons-in-law wouldn't heed. The angels had to urge him and his wife and two daughters, and still he lingered and he wouldn't get out. And when they told him to get to the mountain, he argued with them, and he wanted to go into another small city. But then they told him, don't look back. Lot's wife looked back. She turned into a column or a pillar of salt. Then the two daughters, and I won't read that part of it, but I think we know that. When the two daughters who had escaped with their father, for whatever reasons they reasoned, they got their father drunk, committed incest, and bore two children. But what we have here, we don't have, let's say, if we have in our minds that God has rescued perfect people, he didn't. He rescued Lot. He rescued those who belong to him. We ask the question, is God merciful or what? He's very merciful. He does whatever he can to rescue people. And he did, he certainly did for Lot. Right here then, I think we can take a look at what's the rule here. What will God do? God will indeed render his judgment. He will carry it out like he said. He has to, simply because he's God. And however, he does make a difference. He will do what is right for his people who may be living in that kind of a society, yet he will protect them. These are very important points. Now, in 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4, 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4, "For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into the chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment," so he did it to the angels, "and did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of the eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly." God was going to render a judgment upon the age and the time of Noah. So it says he saved Noah, but yet there were eight of them, all told that he saved, Noah's family. "And turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly, and delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked." So it says he saved Noah, he's prepared to save. He delivered righteous Lot. So God can do that. "For that righteous man dwelling," verse 8, "among them, tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds." Verse 9, "Then the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of trial." That's the word, is how the word should be understood. Trial, not temptation that is being tempted with evil, but even though that is true, he knows how to deliver you out of your temptations, but out of trial, impending trial, tribulation. He can deliver you out of that. "And to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment." God knows how to do that. But in both cases of Noah and Lot, it was unique. That is, in the way that he did it. He told Noah, build an ark. I'll give you 120 years. And you can build an ark, you can save yourself. He would continue the human race through Noah and his sons and his wives. However, with Lot, he said, just simply get out. And he took him out. So, done different ways at different times. But God's judgment was there. God steps in, God decides to make a judgment. He says it's time, then it's time. Now, Jesus compares the sudden events of the end time day of the Lord to the events of Noah and Lot. Let's notice in Luke 17, beginning with verse 26. "And as it was in the days of Noah, so will it also be in the days of the Son of Man." What does it mean, the days of the Son of Man? Well, not the days in which Jesus was living then, but the days in which he would be returning. And it speaks of in verse 24. This is the day, talking about the Son of Man will be in his day. This is how it's going to be. In verse 27, "They ate, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. Likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot, they ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, and they built. But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even so will it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed." Let's talk about that day. Now we've talked, I think we have explained this before, and I specifically remember explaining this on the Feast of Trumpets either last year or the year before last, that this is not the day that Jesus Christ actually returns, the day in which his feet stand on the Mount of Olives, or the day, the actual day of the moment in which he performs the resurrection of the dead, when he actually descends to this earth. This is not that day, but it's a general period of time that it's speaking about here. So this is the day when the Son of Man is revealed. That is, God begins to make himself known. He begins to reveal himself to the inhabitants of the earth. They begin to know who he is. I talked to a gentleman on the phone this week. He called in to inquire about the church, and of course the whole subject of what happened in Louisiana came up. And he said, well, why would God use destruction just to get people to listen to him? I said, that's a very good question. And so I proceeded to answer it. I think that's an answer. I think that answer, I think you would be able to explain. Man has never listened to God. They've had plenty of opportunity to listen to God. They can know God in a number of ways. One of the best ways they can know him is the fact that he is the creator. And even though he can be known, or that they know who he is through the creation, they may not know everything about him so far as his plan and so far as the revealed knowledge. They can take steps then to seek him and to go further and try to get to know him. But man has simply never done that. Man simply has never wanted to listen to God. In fact, the first men, man and woman, hid themselves from God and showed that they were a little bit anxious about what he might have to say, mistrustful toward him, because they had been they had been poisoned by the serpent. Anytime somebody starts talking to you about somebody else, your mind becomes affected, and so nothing's the same in your relationship toward that person again. That happens so many times, so we've got to be very careful about that kind of a principle in allowing that to happen to us. However, this spread to all of mankind, and they were never prepared to listen to him. They never would look at his goodness. They would never trust in him for what could come through him and the blessings that he continually promised. They would never accept this. And so they continue going on down the same road. Now when he speaks, remember, it's his creation. He has a right to speak. He has a right to make himself known. Now here, God is beginning to make himself known, as it says, the day in which the Son of Man is revealed. That is, revealed in a very powerful way, in a way that he's never been revealed before. So we have some things that this is the way Christ is describing this time period right here. Not the day in which he's returning, but the day or the time period sometime before he actually descends, he is going to begin to make himself known to the inhabitants of the earth. So it says in verse 31, in that day, he who was on the housetop and his goods on the house, let him not come down to take them away. And likewise, the one who was in the field, let him not turn back. So, he is likening that to the suddenness of the way it took place with the flood, the way it took place with Sodom and Gomorrah, that somehow, some way, you're going to get the idea that something is impending. Maybe it's something that you've already known about that is going to happen, but now all of a sudden, there it is, it's going to happen. He says, go right there. Right there and there, go, get out. Don't stop. Don't look back, just keep going. You don't have time for that, similar to what God told Lot and urged upon him, you know, to go. Likewise, the one who was in the field. All right, that could be, it doesn't mean like you're right there in the field, you got a little field next to your house, and you can go back in, and it doesn't mean that. And the way it was done that day, some of you could be tending your herds and flocks maybe miles and miles away from where you are. And he says, if you understand that there is an impending disaster, go. Don't even go back to your house. Don't worry about trying to get something out of your house. He said, remember Lot's wife. I don't know what Lot's wife did. But there is an implication here that she not only looked back, she may have turned back. That seems, that could be. Christ may have intended that, but that's what she did. Whoever seeks to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life will preserve it. Now, if you say, I can't leave, I might lose my life. That's what a lot of the people in New Orleans are saying. I don't want to leave. Even though the waters are around them. You know, there's disease, there's death. I don't want to leave. I don't want to go to another place. Whoever seeks to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life will preserve it. That is, if you take whatever action, you simply don't know necessarily where you might go or where you would have to go or what's down the road. You only know you can't stay here and it appears you might lose your life. That's the way it looks. Then you're actually preserving it. I tell you, in that night there will be two men in one bed. The one will be taken. The other will be left. Two women will be grinding together. One will be taken, the other left. Two men in the field. One will be taken, the other left. So I think we're talking about the same incident here. And we're not talking, incidentally, we're not talking about a resurrection from the dead. This is not the time that Jesus Christ returns. you don't have a choice in this kind of a situation whether you return back to your house or not. You're either resurrected or you're not resurrected whenever Jesus Christ returns at the last trump. What you have here is, for instance, you got two people. They are, let's say, they work together. They're close together. They're working together in the field with two women or whatever. And one knows that they have to leave. The other one doesn't know that, or is not convinced, similar to Lot's sons-in-laws, or anybody else who may have heard, oh, yes, it's coming. No, they don't grasp that point. They don't understand that. They don't believe that. They're not in tune with what might happen. But one is and another isn't. Now, I started to say a moment ago, this is not the resurrection from the dead, because some people do take this passage here, a similar passage in Matthew 28, along with 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, that does talk about the resurrection of the dead when Jesus Christ returns, and try to make that out to be the rapture. That's where they get these scriptures from, the idea of the rapture, that people are raptured away before all of this destruction and they are held in some place, away from the earth. They're up there, and then everything, all hell breaks loose down here on earth. You got to fight the beast. You know, and you got all Tim LaHaye's novels. You know, he's got them out there. He makes good money on that. Just writing stories about people who are left behind. You've seen that series? You've heard it? You heard of it? I hope you have. Because he's written a number of novels about people who are raptured away, then everybody else who was left behind, and all of the adventures and the plots and everything that, you know, the plots against the beast power and everything else that's happening on this earth, and they revolve it around, you know, people, individuals. It's, you know, quite interesting stories. But it's all based upon the erroneous idea of the rapture theory that they get out of these scriptures. Now, while it is true, this is prior to the return of Christ. It's certainly not a rapture, because he just says, well, where? And where are they going to be taken, and what it means? He's likening this to Noah, who was saved. He's likening this to Lot, then, who was taken just simply out of the place. There's a question here in the minds of the disciples who are listening to him. And so they ask the question. They answered and said to him, where, Lord? Where what? Where are they going to be taken? And so he said to them, wherever the body is, there the eagles will be gathered together. There's been a great deal of explanation or let's say speculation rather, about, well, what does God mean about that? What does Jesus mean that? Well, one thing you know right off, he's not telling you specifically where, is he? What he's basically saying is, you don't have to worry about that. You will know where. You will know where the body is, wherever the eagles are gathered together. Now, what does he mean by that? Well, I grew up on a farm, and every now and again there would be an animal that's missing. Dad says, boys, I want you to go find that animal. That animal hadn't shown up for 3 or 4 days. Well, we would go out looking, and pretty soon we would see the vultures. And that's how that word eagle is referred to. We would see the vultures circling around, and it would be kind of far away, and so we would just simply follow that, and sure enough, there's that animal that already died, and we have to go back and report to my dad, no, sorry, Dad, we lost that animal, it's gone. But you would know. That's how you would know. And that's what he's saying. He says, just like a body, or the body, or a carcass, that's where the vultures will be, that's where. What's he saying? You'll know. It won't be hard to tell, but you will know. Those who know, those who should know, will know. And that's all he told them. And he didn't get very specific about that. But he's giving conditions as to the way it would be for those who then would be taken, those who would be spared. And the point simply being, he knows how to deliver. He knows where to deliver, as we have already seen. Zephaniah chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, Zephaniah. Chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. Gather yourselves together, yes, gather together, O undesirable nation, before the decree is issued, or the day passes like chaff, before the Lord's fierce anger comes upon you. In other words, before this happens, before the day of the Lord's anger comes upon you. Now, the day of the Lord is going to come. The day of the Lord is the day in which he is going to begin to reveal himself. That's the day. So before that, verse 3, seek the Lord, all you meek of the earth, who have upheld his justice. Seek righteousness. Seek humility. It may be that you will be hidden in the day of the Lord's anger. You want to be hidden. You really want to be hidden. So he says now, then seek the Lord, you meek of the earth. That is, those who are teachable, those who seek righteousness, that seek righteousness, seek his justice, his humility, all of these things we should be seeking. Now, when should we be doing this? Daniel chapter 6 and verse 10. Daniel 6 and verse 10. Now, here's the story where Daniel was thrown in the lion's den. If you remember, there were some trumped up charges against Daniel, and they implicated King Darius, who got him to sign a decree saying that anybody who worshipped some other god, of course, had to be put to death. Daniel, they knew Daniel was going to get caught in this, and the King Darius didn't quite understand what was happening, so he went ahead and signed a decree. And that was the law of the Medes and the Persians, and that could never be reversed. So, verse 10, now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home. In his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees 3 times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. That tells you something. That this man has always served God. He was not going to stop now because of that. And he wasn't going to do it in secret. In other words, this is what it came down to. Either God's going to save him out of this or not. Verse 16, he was convicted. The king tried to get him out of it. He couldn't do it. So he was then taken to the lion's den. And it says in verse 16, so the king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of the lions. But the king spoke, saying to Daniel, your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. So there's a point he's making here. In other words, you don't start seeking God when you get in trouble. Seeking God is a matter of our consistent way of life all along. And then when it comes down to this, then it says he will deliver you. This is the king saying this. And this king here is quite convinced of it. God will deliver you out of this. And verse 20, the next morning, the king, of course, is very distraught, fasted all night. Then he came to the den, and he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? And, of course, the answer was yes. He goes on and says in verse 22, I was innocent before you, before God, and have done no wrong before the king. And so we find Daniel, as his habit was, simply always served God, as it says, as his custom was, from the early days. And he could count on God saving him. It wasn't a matter, he gets in trouble, here's the trouble, and then he turns to God. Now, what God does in a situation like that, I think you're up to God's mercy as to what he will do. But what we ought to do is be serving God continually. And therefore, we can be assured of that protection. In Daniel chapter 3, verse 17. Daniel 3, 17. Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego. They were going to throw them in the fiery furnace. They wouldn't bow down to this image. It says, if that is the case, verse 17, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. However, if he doesn't, let it be known, this is what we're still going to do. In other words, they were reconciled to whatever God willed at that time, but they said, they were quite certain, he would deliver them. He would deliver them. Now, I'll give you a number of examples. We've seen the statements of Christ. Is this something that you can count on? Should you see it in that way? Let's turn over to Psalm 50. Psalm 50. I want to point something out to you, and maybe a little bit different ways of looking at some of the things that are being said here. Psalm 50, verse 14 and 15. Offer to God thanksgiving. Pay your vows to the Most High. Call upon me in the day of trouble. I will deliver you, and you shall glorify me. Now, that's what he says. But let's ask something about the Psalms here, a couple of points I want to make. Is this just something to give us a good feeling? Something that's somewhat comforting, but maybe we don't see it as an absolute. Let me tell you something. When God expresses something here and he says something as to this is what he will do, this is the way he is. He's trying to help us to understand this is what God will do in this time of a situation. Call upon me in the day of trouble. I will deliver you. Now, this isn't just be in time trouble. Maybe some of us get in trouble quite often. I don't know. I hope we don't. But let's say if we do, are you able to do this? Something comes upon you because not as a result of your own doing. He will deliver you, and you shall glorify me. This is what the king said in Daniel, King Darius. He said to glorify God. Nebuchadnezzar said this after God saved him, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He glorified God, didn't he? I mean, these people, I mean, they God was glorified because God backed up what he said he would do. He's not, of course, emphasizing our righteousness or our goodness. That's not it. The glory, of course, goes to Him. But if God makes the statements in the Bible that are absolutely sure that He will bring judgment upon this world, the way He does it is this. He makes the statement. He says, I made the statement, and now I'm going to carry it out that you may know. All of these things are confirmed by what He did. Let's see if there's a scripture that comes to mind. I think I could show you this in Daniel chapter, Daniel chapter 9, that he has done this to show that He will do exactly as He says. Oh yeah, verse 14. Therefore, the Lord has kept the disaster in mind, that is the one that He prophesied, and brought it upon us, for the Lord our God is righteous in all the works which He does, but we have not obeyed His voice. There in other places, he's saying that He said it and He confirmed what He said He would do by carrying it out. That's the only way that people then begin to respect God. If God does this in carrying out His judgment, will He also absolutely carry it out on behalf of His people who serve Him? I think we have to, we put it in just that way because we want to look at it this way. This is what God says He will do. He will absolutely do that, and it's something that we can count on. In fact, Psalm 41 through 94. You can skim these psalms, and you will find so many direct statements of protection and safety and refuge and salvation and deliverance in those psalms. There's about 53 psalms. Now, they are even more widespread than that. But you will find that in those particular psalms, they are, let's say, quite a bit more concentrated. It's a matter of just going through it and marking them and saying, this is what God says He will do. This is what He will absolutely do. Is it something that we can take confidence in? These are not just nice little sayings that give us a nice feeling that we read before we go to bed at night. This is not the way we ought to read psalms. This is the very Word of God. And this is what He says He will do. And it's something that you can have complete confidence in and assurance in that He will carry out what He says. Let's go back very briefly. I'm going to cover a couple of points here. Psalm 41, verse 1 and 2. Blessed is he who considers the poor, for the Lord will deliver him in time of trouble. The Lord will preserve him and keep him alive, and he will be blessed in the earth. You will not deliver him to the will of his enemies. The Lord will strengthen him on his bed of illness and will sustain him in his sick bed. So we've got quite a broad promise here, a promise that God says that he would do. And David claimed these promises, as we see. Chapter 46, verses 1 through 3. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help, our immediate help, in time of trouble. Therefore, we will not fear. Even though the earth be moved, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, and though the waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling. I think he's covered earthquakes, he's covered floods, he's covered hurricanes here. I think a volcano or two is even, he's got it all covered right here. You know, maybe a few other things. So you have his wonderful promises that we can absolutely count on. In Psalm 62 is especially good. Look, I don't have time to read that, but there we are. Those psalms that I referred to you are quite amazing. Let's go over now and cover Psalm 91. Now here is one right here. He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say to the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I will trust. Surely he shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the perilous pestilence. He shall cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you shall take refuge. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by day, nor of the pestilence that walks in darkness, nor of the destruction that lays waste at noonday. And there's a lot of destruction and pestilence and disease. So he's covering quite a few things here. 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right side, but it shall not come near you. Only with your eyes shall you look and see the reward of the wicked. In other words, you'll see this. Lot saw these things. Noah saw this. Even Abraham saw it afar off. Some of the things that were happening is quite amazing. The people who live in the end time, God's people, will see this and experience this. Because you have made the Lord, who is my refuge, even the Most High, your dwelling place, no evil shall befall you, nor shall any plague come near your dwelling, for he will give his angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways, and that in their hands they shall bear you, lest you dash your foot against a stone. This was quoted by the devil to apply to Christ when he tried to tempt Christ. And Christ wouldn't have it, because you don't put yourself in some type of foolish situation and then expect God to save you. That's not what this means. It means you're doing your best to serve God, and things get beyond your control. You can't help yourself. God has to step in and offer you his deliverance. You shall tread upon the lion and the cobra, the young lion and the serpent. You shall trample underfoot. Because he has set his love upon me, therefore I will deliver him. I will set him on high because he has known my name. He shall call upon me, and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life I will satisfy him and show him my salvation. And once again, the word salvation here refers more to the idea of being saved from harm. Being saved from harm. So we have some extraordinary statements in the Psalms that God then is revealing his mind as to what he will do for his people in the end time, and at other times too, for that matter. Revelation 12. Let's conclude here. Here then is something that is quite specific. As Luke 17 was quite specific in its time frame. Here you have the time of the end. Now we know that it is, because in verse 12, in Revelation chapter 12, the time frame is, we know, the day of the Lord. The devil has been cast to the earth for the final time. He has come down having great wrath because he knows he has a short time. This is a short time in which is left. Now let's notice what happens right here during this short time. In the short time of what? Well, we know that the devil is going to then be completely restrained in the bottom, in a pit for 4,000 years. And so he's got a short time until that happens. Now the dragon, verse 13, saw that he had been cast to the earth. He persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. The woman is the church. So he persecutes the woman. But the persecution obviously is so bad in this instance that the woman was given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness to her place. I understand there's a lot of figurative language here, but you do get the impression through it all that she has to go somewhere else. She can't stay where she is. She's got to go to a place that's called her place. where she is nourished for a time, times, and half a time, and you get the idea. That is quite specific. We understand that to mean 3.5 years. From the presence of the serpent. So you can't have the devil around or nearby because his intention is to persecute and even destroy those people who are, well, who God's people, the woman. So you've got to stay away from the presence of the serpent. So they're obviously protected from him. So the serpent then spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that it might cause her to be carried away by the flood. That could mean intense persecution, intense propaganda, lies, something comes out of the mouth of the serpent, cause her to be carried away by the whole flood of lies, manipulations, untruths, fear, scare tactics, whatever he does to the woman. It could mean actual armies or people that he sends after them. You could understand that either way. But the earth helped the woman. The earth opened its mouth, swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. So God supernaturally caused this to come to nothing. The dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So there comes a time at the right at the very end where the children of the woman, that is, those people who are converted, those people who hear, who understand, who learn from the teachings and the preachings of the church. They are the seed of the church. And those who come, that's who the seed is. So there's a remnant then. They have the commandments. They have the testimony of Christ. And then he goes to make war with them. Now, I'm not here to try to interpret every little part of it. I simply want to make one point. The point is, he's making very clear that at the end time, so far as the woman, meaning the church, as it exists, is going to receive, will receive protection from God. He puts it in figurative language, rather vague language, so that you don't know exactly what it means. Just as Christ said back in Luke 17, they said, well, where, Lord? Well, you don't know exactly where, do you? I mean, some people think they do know where, and they've staked out caves, and they've done a few things like this. Well, that's fine. Or maybe it's not so fine. It just depends on how you look at it. I don't think he just simply doesn't tell you, because you're going to have to live by faith at a time like that. One thing that is sure, he says he will give, he will provide that protection. I want to make this very clear today, that this is what he will do. He will do this for his people because he's God. He'll make a difference. People who are going to commit themselves to him, who are going to obey him in faith, God will back them up. Because that's what God does. And God will indeed save, and he will deliver his people. He promises that. Well, thank you very much. Let's all keep the faith. And we'll see you next time.